the modern ventilator actually came to be based on that collective experience with polio and the iron lung. And the story is quite fascinating. Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism. Disclaimer. The Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is exclusively meant for general informational purposes and should not be regarded as a substitute for professional medical services, including medicine or nursing. It does not create a doctor-patient relationship, and any reliance on the information provided in the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. The content is not intended to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the host and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with the host or guests. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we got a good one today. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Neil Ferguson. Neil Ferguson, not the British historian, but the intensive care unit physician, is a leading force within the University Health Network, which is Canada's foremost research hospital group. As the head of critical care at University Health Network, he embodies excellence in his field. The hospital that he works at is the prestigious Toronto General Hospital, which has been ranked in the top five worldwide over the past few years. He has a career distinguished by groundbreaking contributions, including service as the regional medical lead for critical care during the tumult of the pandemic and directing clinical research at Toronto General Hospital. He's published a ton, so he has published many, many articles, probably 50 times more than I will ever publish in my career. He's received a staggering $46 million in grant support, which is money that he's received to do meaningful work in studies that underscore his commitment to advancing critical care medicine. Beyond his remarkable professional achievements, Dr. Neil Ferguson's personal journey adds depth to his narrative. A proud Scotsman, he navigates the complexities of life with a unique perspective enriched by his diverse experiences. Married with four children spanning two generations, Dr. Ferguson's devotion to family mirrors his dedication to patient care. While medicine may be his calling, his passion for golf actually hints at an alternate path. He might have ended up a golf pro if he didn't follow on this path that destiny diverted towards the pursuit of medical excellence in the field of critical care. So today we have the privilege of delving into the multifaceted world of critical care with Dr. Neil Ferguson. We start with a bit of a history lesson and we talk about the iron lung. Now, a lot of you might be able to picture these devices that people with polio, which was a respiratory virus that really made people weak and so they couldn't breathe. And even if you Google iron lung, you can see these giant boxes that we connected to people who couldn't breathe to help them breathe. And by happenstance, which we talk about today, the modern ventilator actually came to be based on that collective experience with polio and the iron lung. And the story is quite fascinating. So we start off with a little bit of a history lesson and then how our stumbles through that history led to the current state of critical care medicine today. And we talk about what critical care medicine means. Is it just connected to machines? What is life support? When is life support going to help you? How crazy and how intense are these machines? What do they do to our bodies? So we get into all of that while also shining a spotlight on the indispensable role of teamwork in delivering exemplary patient care in the critical care environment, while also talking about the profound experience of witnessing patients connected to life-sustaining machines. Some of the checks and balances that we have to do as healthcare workers to make sure that we're looking at our patients as human beings, and not science experiments connected to machines. Whether you're a medical enthusiast eager to expand your horizons or simply captivated by the inner workings of critical care, this episode is for you. Get ready to sit down and join us for an enlightening and entertaining conversation with Dr. Neil Ferguson. It's been a while. The iron lung, is that where it all started? Ventilators?
Actually, there's a history of mechanical ventilation that goes back even before that. negative pressure ventilation, which is what the iron lung concept has been around all of the 20th century, essentially. And during the polio era in the 40s or 50s, you know, there's some famous photos of fields of iron lungs at UCLA Children's, with lots of kids being supported with negative pressure ventilation.
And what happened to polio?
Well, polio went away because we had vaccines. And there's an interesting story about that. In response to polio, in fact, that we have modern invasive positive pressure ventilation, in fact. And there's famously, there was a conference for about polio experts in Copenhagen in Denmark in 1952. People from all over the world came and talked about it, and they probably brought polio with them, because the following autumn, there was a major polio outbreak, epidemic in Copenhagen, and lots of people were dying because they were getting not just respiratory muscle weakness, or not just trouble breathing, but they had what they call bulbar polio, where they had also had trouble controlling the muscles in their mouth and in their throat, and so difficulty swallowing and clearing secretions. So people were, and although the iron lung can help with moving air in and out of your lungs, it obviously doesn't help with coughing or clearing secretions. So lots of people, and especially children, were dying because of respiratory failure that couldn't be fixed with this iron lung. So a smart anesthetist named Bjorn Ibsen thought that, you know what, these patients are hypoventilating, we're not getting enough air in and out of them. And he pitched an idea that people thought was crazy, was that was putting in a tracheotomy and then hand bag mask, bag trach ventilating patients, and tried this on one girl who was dying of bulbar palsy, and she turned around quickly. And then they expanded this across their whole hospital, and the mortality rate fell from like 90% to 10% over the next 6 months. And they had a whole team of medical students, actually, mostly, who were the ventilators. They would sit in 6 or 12 hour shifts and squeeze the bag and actually inflate, push air into to patients' lungs, and got them through their bout of respiratory failure from polio.
Would you have done medical school if you knew that's what you had to do?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think I'm not sure if that would happen today. I think it was a different era, but it's pretty interesting. And then from there, we never look back in terms of how we ventilate patients, mostly using positive pressure and tubes to help get air in and out of patients' lungs.
So to get this straight, polio is a virus that makes you weak. And so all those pictures, when you look at those classic pictures of these people connected to these big boxes, right, the iron lung, most people with polio, that virus, were too weak to breathe on their own. And so the machine helped. And what you're saying is negative pressure, so I guess sucking air in. And then people got even sicker with a subsequent wave of polio that ironically happened after a polio conference. And those people were not only weak with their breathing, but were also having issues with swallowing and clearing their secretions. So more reasons to pollute their lungs. And then by accident, we figured out by making holes in their neck, right? A tracheotomy, a hole in their neck, right into their airway, and having medical students squeeze air into their lungs and provide positive pressure. That's how we figured out mechanical ventilation. Like, it was kind of a happenstance, a mistake.
Yeah, well, I think like many advances, there's some serendipity involved about having the right person in the right place and being prepared. We have to remember that, you know, in these days, we take a lot of our knowledge of respiratory physiology and being able to monitor patients in real time for granted. So in patients in the intensive care unit who are on ventilators, we measure blood gases, which allows us to know how much CO2 and how much oxygen is in the blood at any given time. In the 50s, those tests were not available. They didn't know how much CO2. They could guess about oxygen. They weren't able to measure CO2 directly, and were only indirectly sort of guessing at that from other lab tests that they could do. So we all breathe. Right now, we're breathing, and probably everybody listening, or most people listening to this podcast, are breathing using negative pressure ventilation. We contract our diaphragm. The diaphragm is like a piston and moves down. That creates negative pressure within the chest, and air goes in. And that's how we breathe. And then we relax the diaphragm and the breath comes out. That's normal breathing. And I think that's when we created iron lungs, people were thinking, okay, well, this is how we normally breathe. So let's try this for helping people breathe makes sense. But the truth is, it's difficult to replicate negative pressure breathing using an external box. It doesn't work quite as well. And we're not able to ventilate people as well as we would like using only negative pressure ventilation, which is another reason why when we kind of happened on to positive pressure, it stuck.
So ventilation, it's just your lungs' main job, right, is to expel carbon dioxide, right, the toxin in your blood and the waste after your body's consumed oxygen, and replace your bloodstream with oxygen. So your lungs are that vital structure that are doing that. And so when you say ventilate somebody, are you talking about getting rid of their carbon dioxide, or are you talking about giving them oxygen, or is this a mixture of both?
Yeah, you're right. When I say ventilate, I'm usually talking about getting rid of CO2. That's when we say somebody is hypoventilating, or they're not ventilating enough, they're not able to blow off the CO2 that they're producing, usually because their lungs are not working as efficiently as they normally would.
But what if you just let it ride? What if you let somebody's CO2 levels go up and stay high? Right? Like, I've seen people get sleepy from that. At which point is it too dangerous? And like, now we can check someone's carbon dioxide on blood testing. But back then, were they just looking at how sleepy somebody was? Like, how would they decide when you needed to help get rid of that carbon dioxide?
Yeah, well, back then, I don't think they really knew. And in fact, the one thing that they were able to measure was bicarbonate in the blood. And so when CO2 is very high in the bloodstream, it gets buffered, and some of it gets changed into bicarbonate, the component of baking soda, if you like. And they were able to measure bicarbonate in the blood, but they thought that bicarbonate was high because they thought the primary problem was high bicarbonate and not a secondary problem because of high CO2.
Okay. Now, when we look at positive pressure, right, the iron lung is helping us to suck air in, which is replacing our normal function and normal physiology, right, as you describe. And then positive pressure is what? Forcing air into people. And that's what they were doing when these medical students were squeezing air through holes in everyone's necks.
That's right. You know, most modern ventilators are blowers, essentially. They blow in they turn on flow, and they blow in a mixture of oxygen and air. And by doing that, they help patients do the work of breathing that they need to do, which is often higher than it is normally. And that's why they're sick and in need of help with their breathing.
So what about Elon Musk's statement that with COVID, the ventilators did more harm than the virus itself, right? You're blowing air into lungs. Can that damage lungs? Is that statement true?
Yeah, I think that things can be true, but also not true. So ventilators can harm lungs. We can harm lungs with high pressures, for sure. But to say that ventilators killed more people than the virus is a complete non-starter. There's a lot of what we call confounding in that statement, where people were sick and needed help with their breathing, and then people who were sick also died more. But to say that there's a causal link between putting somebody on the ventilator and dying from COVID is just not the case. I think we learned a lot during the first year of COVID, the first couple of waves, where we were looking after a lot of people. And initially, you know, everybody had a lot of trepidation. Nobody had ever seen or looked after a patient with COVID-19 respiratory failure before. So there was lots of questions, and people were extrapolating from what we knew about caring for patients with pneumonia or with flu or something like that. But as everybody got more comfortable and sort of calm down and realize that really these patients were at a fundamental level, you could still use the same fundamentals, that the same rules that you had normally used for looking after other patients with respiratory failure, things settled down somewhat, I would say.
So is COVID different? Like, when you think about pneumonia or influenza, right, the other viruses and bacteria that are out there, you know, your lungs get inflamed, they get full of gunk. You are sick otherwise, right? So some of those things that you talked about, difficulty clearing secretions, perhaps being a little bit drowsy and not being able to manage the normal respiratory function, all of those things happen. And so the purpose of a ventilator is to help do what the lungs are struggling to do, because they might have some gunk inside of them, because you might not be breathing that well. Is COVID-19 in any way different than all of those other things that we have experience managing? And if so, what are the differences?
I would say it presents a little differently than we've seen people with. So you could have a bacterial pneumonia, and those patients usually come in and go from being quite well to very sick if they're going to end up being very sick quite quickly. Same thing with bad flu. Once people are sick enough to need to be hospitalized, usually they get sick very quickly and have need of a lot of help. With COVID, we definitely saw a couple of different things where patients could have quite low oxygen levels and not really feel distressed. Like normally when you have pneumonia, there's lots of inflammation in your lung, there's lots of gunk you're coughing out, and if you're having it feels hard to breathe, you have a sense of shortness of breath, and you're distressed by low levels of oxygen. Whereas with COVID, there was certainly a significant group of people with what they sort of termed so-called happy hypoxemia, where we were measuring their oxygen levels. And normally we want to keep saturations or the percent of hemoglobin that has oxygen attached to it sort of above 90%. Normals are in the high 90s. And, you know, there was lots of patients walking around with saturations in the 70s and 80s and not being very symptomatic with COVID. And the other abnormality I think we saw more with this virus than others, and it's probably related to some inflammation within the blood vessels within the lung and how the blood vessels match with the air going in and out, where we saw lots of, the medical term for this is dead space, where patients were breathing a lot, but despite breathing a lot, their CO2 levels were not going down. So they're having a lot of inefficient ventilation because of what we would call, the technical term would be ventilation and perfusion mismatching. What that means is basically the blood going through the lung wasn't getting to where the air going into the lung was going.
So if your oxygen level's in the 70s, but you feel fine, the normal is in the high 90s, right?
Yep.
And I know doing ward medicine, like when I'm caring for people who aren't in the intensive care unit, I like seeing oxygen levels above 88. And we talk about once you drop below 88, it can lead to catastrophic tissue impacts and damage. But if someone's feeling fine and their oxygen level's in the 70s, is that a bad thing? Like, can you just let them ride it out? Or is that going to cause chronic damage to their brain, their kidneys, to other organs? Or who knows?
I guess we don't know the real answer to that. I mean, there's a certain group of people who walk around with low levels of oxygen, like, for example, some patients with congenital heart disease who are chronically blue and have low oxygen saturations. And if it happens slowly over time, often the body can find compensatory mechanisms, the same way that people are adapted and able to live at very high altitudes. But if you suddenly parachuted into that very high altitude, you'd be extremely distressed. Because what we really care about is not just the oxygen saturation, but it's about getting oxygen to your tissues and to your organs, as you suggested. So that involves not just the oxygen saturation level, but how much hemoglobin you have in your blood and how well your heart is working and how well it's able to pump that blood around to other organs. So if somebody was walking around feeling fine with a saturation of 70%, but their kidneys were functioning well and they were awake and alert and talking, you might say, okay, that's fine. Their oxygen delivery seems to be okay. I'd still be nervous about that patient, because the other reason that we like to fixate it, it's not like you gave the threshold of 88. It's not like 85 is that much different than 88, but it's around that number. Remember that there's something called the oxygen hemoglobin or the oxyhemoglobin saturation curve. And this, we have to remember that oxygen in our blood is mostly transported bound to hemoglobin. That's the stuff in the business stuff in red blood cells. So, and there's a relationship between the amount of oxygen in your blood, what we measure as the PO2, the partial pressure of oxygen, and how much is attached to hemoglobin. And it's not a straight line. So there's a significant sharp inflection point around 88% usually. Above that, you can have relatively big changes in the amount of oxygen, and the percentage saturation won't change very much. But once you get past that inflection point, then a very small drop or relatively small drop in the amount of oxygen in your blood can lead to a big drop in the proportion that's bound to hemoglobin. And that's the number that really matters in terms of oxygen delivery. That's why we're another reason that we would certainly be monitoring such a patient very closely, because they might go from walking around with 70% and then a small change, and now suddenly their oxygen saturation is 30%.
Yeah, and that's when organs that need oxygen for each movement, like the heart, can really run into trouble. When I think back to like the collective learning experience we went through with the pandemic, and, you know, obviously you had a huge responsibility preparing a large hospital and groups of hospitals together to prepare for this onslaught of sick COVID-19 people. And we saw all the pictures from Italy, right? Like at that point, Italy, China, you know, people dying outside of hospitals. And I remember when we were preparing for this, there were conversations about removing all of the tables in the cafeteria in one of the hospitals we work at to make room for hospital beds and to make room for ventilators. And there was a rumor going around amongst some of the intensivists that I work with before the first wave actually happened here that we had not prepared for this and we were off by an order of magnitude on ventilators. That based on the population that we have, based on how many people needed ventilators in Italy and in China, we were hundreds of thousands of ventilators short. Now, obviously that didn't happen, but were you panicked at all? Were you worried when you were preparing for this?
Yeah, we had, I'll admit that we had moments of concern, shall we say, when you start, because this all, our response to COVID, and you know, we had rapidly set up the a province-wide command center to try and manage critical care in an efficient way across the system, because obviously we knew that COVID was not going to necessarily obey the laws of distribution of critical care. Critical care services are not uniformly spread across the province. They're concentrated in larger cities and in teaching hospitals and things like this. And we figured that there was no natural reason why the virus would follow those rules. So we would have to be responsive. But when we first sat down and started to think about, okay, what are we going to need? What's going to happen? And talking to, as you said, talking to colleagues in Italy, you could quickly come up with some, depending on what the attack rate was and what proportion of the population was going to get infected at a given time and how many of them and what proportion of those would require ventilation. You could rapidly get into very large numbers of patients needing intensive care and mechanical ventilators. So I did spend a significant chunk of time in March and April of 2020 trying to source alternative forms of ventilation, including testing, well, trying to procure or get ventilators from every company that made ventilators. As you can imagine, every other country in the province was trying to do the same. So that wasn't extremely successful. We got some, but also like testing things like strategies to have two patients connected to one ventilator, and or here's a new ventilator that somebody's invented that essentially is a Danish medical student. It's a mechanical squeezing of the bag that we would hand bag patients with, and we were sitting around high level tables talking about these options seriously. And then, you know, at times I just have to interject and say, okay, these, you know, we're talking about this as if this all makes sense, but we just have to recognize that this is so far off of what we would consider normal safe practice. It was craziness for a while.
So no one was like, instead of procuring more ventilators, let's just increase medical student enrollment and have them do what they did in the 50s and just bag mask. So if you have someone on a bag mask and you're squeezing, right, which is a little like if you've seen people on, you know, Rescue 911 and on Grey's Anatomy, they have a little plastic bag and they're squeezing air. How much different is that from a mechanical ventilator? Like, is it actually pretty close to blowing air in, or is it not even comparable?
It's comparable. The challenge is that it's very sort of unmonitored and maybe unreliable. You don't know, like when we push air in, we're carefully monitoring how much volume is going in, what pressures are the lungs exposed to. And whereas when you're manually just squeezing the bag, you have no idea how much are you ventilating? Is it too much? Is it too little? Are the pressures too high? Are you not ventilating enough? You don't know. It's chiefly that problem.
What's the longest someone's ever been on a ventilator for?
Well, there are people that are on ventilators chronically for years.
But do you know the longest?
I don't know off the top of my head, but for decades, for sure.
Well, and I think that you look at when we're talking about COVID and pneumonias, these people are acutely sick, right? So their lungs are inflamed, they're having damage to other organs. But when you compare that to people who are chronically on ventilators, say they have ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, or some chronic neuromuscular disease. And so their lungs are by and large healthy lungs. They just need help moving the air. Are the impacts of ventilation different in someone who requires one chronically because they have weak muscles compared with people who need it acutely, like who are in the intensive care unit with COVID? Are they exposed to different risks of being on breathing machines?
They probably are, because the lungs are injured already in patients who present with acute, most of the patients who present with acute respiratory failure from pneumonia, from COVID, from an aspiration, they already have an inflammatory hit from whatever made their breathing worse. And that probably potentiates a risk of what we call ventilator-associated lung injury.
And what is that exactly? Is that like the lungs get damaged forever because you're popping the little airways at the end? Like what's happening there?
Yeah, it's usually not damaged forever, but it's certainly damaged, can worsen and actually cause the same kind of type of injury that viral infection or a pneumonia can cause. There's a whole series of elegant scientific experiments in the 70s and 80s that show you can take, you know, normal rabbits, if you like, and do nothing to them other than just expose them to high volumes and high pressures on mechanical ventilation, and they develop terrible respiratory failure that's histopathologically, like under the microscope, looks the same as somebody with respiratory failure following pneumonia or trauma. Because, you know, in medicine and in the ICU particularly, we've had I think there's a general sort of bias to think that, well, if I know what normal is, and I know that this patient is currently abnormal, so if I do things to try to get them back looking more normal, that should be good. And so for many years, the goal when somebody was on a mechanical ventilator, the goal was make the blood gases normal. Like a normal CO2 is 40, a normal PO2 is 100. So let's get those numbers back to where they should be. But in doing so, when patients' lungs were sick, that involved giving much larger breaths than they would normally take and using higher pressures than the lungs were used to seeing. And this from these animal experiments, there came through a series of human clinical trials in patients, culminating in a large trial showing that actually just by reducing the breath size, turning down the tidal volume, limiting the airway pressure that you're delivering, there was a huge reduction in mortality, like 9% absolute reduction in mortality in this landmark trial, which is from 40 to 31%, which is a huge reduction just by paying attention to not injuring the lungs further when they're already been injured.
Progress, not perfection, right? Your lungs are sick, so why are we trying to make the blood gas levels perfect? We're just trying to help give you a little bit of an assist, right? Because if we give too much of an assist, we're going to cause damage.
Exactly right. You know, when patients show up with acute respiratory failure, they have there's an imbalance between the amount of worker breathing that they can do with their own respiratory muscles and the worker breathing that they have to do because of stiff lungs, obstructed airways, and inefficient ventilation. So we're just trying to sort of improve that balance between supply and demand of worker breathing, if you like, and doing so essentially using the minimal amount to get them through without damaging their lungs further.
And so one of the things when you're talking about, you know, putting people on mechanical ventilation and helping them breathe, but also trying to balance the fact that people who are coming into an intensive care unit have pretty sick and diseased lungs to begin with. And you have to be very careful with how you give them life support with the ventilator, because that can cause damage itself. It made me think to some trippy days in the initial waves 1 and 2 of the pandemic, where as a ward internist, right, I would take people who graduated from your ICU, right? So if people survived their stay on a ventilator and they were liberated from the ventilator, you know, they had the breathing tube removed and were ready to go to a medical floor, you would call me or some of my colleagues and we'd come see them and see if they're ready to come over. But there was one hallway where there were a whole bunch of people, mostly young people, and it's kind of like walking by the Matrix, right? Where there's these people connected to so many machines. And one of those machines was ECMO, right? Where they had these giant catheters sticking out of their neck. Like it looked like turkey basters sticking out of their neck. I don't really understand ECMO, but basically that's when someone's lungs are so sick that even a ventilator's not going to help. So you're straight up putting their bloodstream into a fake robotic lung. Like what's going on with ECMO? How did you decide to put someone on that crazy stuff?
Yeah, ECMO stands for extracorporeal, so out of body, membrane oxygenation. It's actually a bit of a misnomer because it's both oxygenation and ventilation. It's essentially using an artificial lung, and there's different ways you can set it up for the COVID-19 pandemic and for respiratory failure, we did a lot of what they call veno-venous or VV ECMO. And that involves, as you said, putting two big intravenous hoses into patients. It's connected with a pump. It sucks blood out, pushes it through this artificial lung where we remove CO2 and put in oxygen. And then the blood goes back more or less to the same point where we took it from, and the heart pumps it around the body as normal. So essentially we're using that when the lungs are so bad that even with a mechanical ventilator, we can't safely get oxygen in or CO2 out.
And people survive ECMO? Like after that, if they survive it, their lungs are better and you put them on the ventilator, or do they get transplants, or do they just go off of that and walk out of there? Like what happens to people once you start it?
Usually, if people are able to recover, their lungs get better. We typically wean from ECMO and get them off ECMO first, and then they're still on a ventilator, and then we wean them off the ventilator, and most of the time their lungs recover. In COVID, there were a few cases where patients developed sort of a lung fibrosis or really had some destructive pneumonia. And so if they recovered enough from the rest of their body, but their lungs were still stuck on ECMO, we did go ahead and do lung transplants in several patients. But the usual expectation of somebody coming in with acute respiratory failure is that we're usually using ECMO as what we call a bridge to recovery, and just trying to buy time to support the patient's oxygen and ventilation while their body figures a way to heal itself.
Have people tried looking at just skipping the ventilator step? Like if you're so sick you need a ventilator, why not just put people on ECMO instead?
Yeah, so there is some of that, and you can find some editorials in the literature saying, do we need ventilators anymore? Let's just use ECMO. The reason that we still typically use ventilators in conjunction with ECMO in respiratory failure is that these patients were so sick that we still had to struggle a little bit to keep oxygen levels adequate while they were on ECMO, and that at least in the early stages often meant keeping them sedated and sometimes paralyzed. If they were awake and trying to take deep breaths, which they often were because of the inflammation in their lungs, that actually interferes with how the ECMO circuit works, and you get some sort of suction events on your cannula, and your flows aren't good enough, and you're not able to support the patient. So partly of that is the reason about ventilating as well, just to protect the airway and make sure that things are fine. And overall, still, we think that there are some potential side effects or complications of ECMO, including bleeding. And often this is not a huge deal. It's some inconvenience bleeding, but there can be serious and even fatal bleeding that can happen in the brain, for example. And truthfully, we and others saw more of that in the COVID-19 patients than we would typically see in other patients who are on ECMO. And so for those reasons, we want to use ECMO when it's necessary, but get off it when it's not.
Well, and just when you describe all of this, it reminds me of how uncomfortable all this stuff is. And, you know, both of us intubate people and put them on breathing machines. And I actually feel that in some ways we do patients a disservice when we talk about, you know, your loved one might need a breathing tube. And it kind of sounds like this tiny little straw that we'll put in and, you know, help you breathe a little bit. But there's a lot of risk associated with that procedure. You have to make someone comfortable. You have to paralyze them. The medications you give them to do that can put them into a cardiac arrest or shock. And then it's super uncomfortable having this little breathing tube, right, jammed down your throat that you have to put people in a medical coma. And for some people, like you describe, even those on ECMO, you need to paralyze them, right? So they're not able to do anything. So it's a very uncomfortable procedure. Have you talked to patients who have been removed from all that stuff? Do they ever share with you what it was like to go through all of that?
Yeah, for sure. We've talked to lots of patients, and some of my colleagues actually are sort of pioneers in the field and leading a post-ICU follow-up clinical and research program. Interestingly, most patients don't remember all that much if they've really been sick, partially because we've given them medications that put them in a coma and also cause some amnesia. But I think also just being that sick causes some memory loss. So they don't remember specifics. Interestingly, though, that feeling of having lost 3 weeks of your life turns out to be quite distressing as well. People wake up and say, well, what do you mean it's February? No, it's I thought it was 2nd of January or something like this. And so one thing that's been described as being helpful is family members sort of keeping a journal of what's happened, sort of having some memory replacement for folks. A lot of this is related to being really critically ill, and there's often a significant recovery time that continues well after the patients have recovered. They're breathing enough to get off of the ventilator and even to leave the ICU, but there's often weeks or months of rehabilitation and physiotherapy and some mental health work-throughs that need to happen after somebody's been through a bout of critical illness. I think that just getting back to your point about how uncomfortable or it is or what the point, I think it kind of comes around to what's the point or what's the expectation? What are we trying to achieve with mechanical ventilation or with ECMO? Because the truth is neither of them are treatments for the underlying problem. It's organ support, essentially. We're trying to do, it's like dialysis. Dialysis doesn't treat kidney disease. It might actually make the kidneys worse, but it does the job of the kidney. So the ventilator or the ECMO machine don't help your lungs get better. They might make it worse, as we talked about already. They try to do the work of the lungs while we wait for the treatments that are happening to kick in. So the key here is thinking about, okay, what are my treatment options and what are my expectations? If you've got a bacterial pneumonia, then great. We're going to give you antibiotics. We might give you steroids these days as well. And we'll wait for several days as your lung heals itself. And then hopefully you're going to be able to come off the ventilator. If you've got a chronic progressive lung disease, or you've got metastatic cancer that's filling your lungs and making it difficult to breathe, then it's a very different situation because now you're not on a, there's no treatment that's available and you're facing all of this short-term pain and discomfort without that expectation of longer-term gain.
Do people at that point get it? You know, like if you're so sick because you have an irreversible disease, like I can only imagine how scary it is to feel like you're drowning, right? Which is how people describe respiratory failure. You know, you just can't get enough air in. Are people often panicked and afraid at that point where you really can't talk much reason into them when you're kind of that language that was so eloquent where you describe this is an organ replacement, right? This is not curing your underlying disease. It's a bridge to your underlying organs improving with the treatment. But if your underlying organs are full of some tumor or say you got a whole bunch of marble shot into your lungs and there's no more room for healthy lung, putting someone on life support with a ventilator is not going to change their outcome in any way. Do you find people get panicked and anxious at that point and you just can't have a normal conversation with them?
It depends on whether the patient has had a chance to really understand what's been happening and what's been progressing over time. Sometimes patients show up in the emergency department and they're already so sick that they personally can't participate in a conversation and their family is distraught and don't know what's going on yet because it's a new diagnosis. And there, that's a very difficult situation. I find most of the time, if it really has been a more progressive disease and the patient has had a chance to come to terms with things, usually patients are much more ready to say, you know what? No, I agree with you. That makes no sense. Please don't put a breathing tube down me because you're not going to be helping me. It's more challenging for family members to understand when they haven't had a chance to hear it directly from the patient already. Their natural tendency, I think quite normally, is to say, if you say, hey, do you want everything done? Yeah, of course I want everything done, right? Why wouldn't I? But it's very important when you're having these conversations to think about, okay, how do we define everything? Surgeons are already ahead of the curve on us about this, where they look at a patient, they say, you know what, the risk is greater than the benefit here. I'm not offering surgery. And the patient says, okay, thank you, doctor. Thanks for giving me that advice. Whereas on the medical side of things, we're often saying, okay, well, we've got this menu here. Do you want us to do CPR? Do you want a breathing machine if your heart stops? And they would say, well, yeah, I guess so. Sure. If you're telling me that's the right thing. So I really try to reframe this around doing everything that's going to be helpful, that's going to help us achieve your health goals.
Yeah, within reason, I totally agree. I find the number of times I see the conversation happen no different than your way right away at McDonald's, which is, you know, you're coming into hospital, you're sick. And we call this the code status discussion, right? We think about do not resuscitate or DNR and full code, which is, you know, doing everything. And if you frame it like that with a patient, you know, if you die, do you want us to revive you? Well, of course, because it's a stupid question. But if you frame it around, if you got so sick that you needed extra supports, here's what we can do. But if you got so much sicker despite that stuff, and that stuff may be antibiotics, maybe extra oxygen, but because we found cancer everywhere, if you got so sick, there'd be no value in replacing that organ because that organ is beyond repair. That would allow us to have a better and more practical conversation. And doing what we do, and especially after having lived through COVID, you know, we all have families, we all have cousins, aunts, uncles, parents, kids. I would have that conversation with my family, just kind of sussing out their interest. Do you have those conversations with your family? Do you have a general understanding of what people around you would want and even kind of explain things for them so that if they're in that unfortunate situation, they can actually make an informed choice or it's already been made?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have these conversations almost explicitly when you can, because I have many, many family meetings where I said, okay, did you ever talk to your mom or your husband or your wife or, about this? And oh, no, we never talked about it. I'm not sure. Because when we're talking to families in the ICU, when the patients are too sick to participate, we're talking to them and saying, okay, let's imagine that if Bob is the patient, let's imagine that Bob is in the room with us and could hear everything that we're talking about, what would he say? What would his opinion be? And often the easiest way to answer that would be saying, well, actually, I know what he'd say because I had that conversation with him 2 months ago. And he said, don't ever keep me alive on a ventilator. You know, in my experience, this question of, oh, do I go on a machine or not is not the right question. It's if I can't get better, should you help me? Should you put me on machines just for the sake of keeping me alive? But if I can't get back to my, if I can't play golf, if I can't be with my family, if I can't hug my kids, then there's no value in that for me. Yeah, so I have these conversations with some of my friends and family, and it's interesting actually to hear that it's important to have them because people actually have different perspectives. My parents are elderly, and they're both very clear that they have a good quality of life right now, and they don't want to be prolonged. If they're not able to continue being independent, they don't want to be prolonged on a ventilator in an ICU. My wife is more aggressive and she wants, don't give up on me. When you say you've done everything, make sure you really have done everything. And that sort of acknowledges there's always some, in most cases, there's some uncertainty about people's ability to recover. In some cases, it's obviously very clear, but there are cases where it's a little bit unknown and people will have different thresholds about how much they're willing to go through in terms of there's some for sure upfront costs of being in a bed, on a ventilator, in an ICU, and for some unknown downstream benefits. And different people have different thresholds about that math.
Totally. It's like the personal, the spiritual, the religious, the culture, like so much plays into it. And I do find in my experience, you know, both of us work with and teach medical students and residents and nurse practitioner students. I've noticed an overall improvement in the comfort level with people who have that conversation and they're getting right into it, right? The code status discussion was often something that was put off. Oh, I didn't have a chance to say it. Oh, it wasn't a good time. Well, of course, it's never a good time to talk about what you want if you die. I find it quite amusing when you start the conversation and you're kind of reading the room and you say, you know, like you're in hospital, you're pretty sick. We think we can help you, but have you ever, wait a minute, doctor, I'm a DNR. Like people straight up just interrupt you. And sometimes people interrupt you the other way. So it's actually, and I do think that the lived experience of COVID actually forced a lot of people to think about this stuff and learn about ventilators and all these things that you're talking about, like the trauma and the kind of experience, the lost memory, the impact on your body, the risk with that, you know, the impact and toll on your family. People actually had a chance to consider that. So I found the conversation became a much easier thing to have. I got to ask you though, you walk in the room as an authority, right? You're a critical care physician. I just got to ask, would you have done critical care if it didn't sound so cool? Like, I'm sure it sounds good at a party, you know, like, what do you do? I'm a critical care doctor. Like people just have these fantasies of you, like putting hearts back in, blood everywhere. If it was, I look after people on a ward where you need a bit more help. Like, would you still have done it?
Would you have done neurosurgery?
I don't know. Two things that I'd say. First of all, and one of the silver linings of COVID is that people now actually, some people actually know what an intensive care or critical care doctor is and what we do. I think pre-COVID, I would tell somebody, I work in the ICU or I'm a critical care doctor. Oh, you're in the emergency, you work in the emergency department, I guess then, right? Or you're a surgeon or something. That's not exactly what we do. So that's one thing. I think people understand that intensive care doctors are sort of looking after people with multiple organs that are failing and often are driving ventilators. I went into critical care mostly because I really liked physiology. Was how I wanted, why I got into human physiology was why I decided to apply to medical school. And then the ICU was, I liked respiratory physiology. So the ICU was a big physiology lab for me with lots of real-time data that I enjoyed a lot. And then honestly, another part of critical care that I didn't go into it for this reason, but an unexpected benefit of it as that I learned as I was doing it is that there's a lot of an impactful human interaction with, cause you're dealing with people often in the worst times of their life with family in a crisis, and being able to say the right things and help some people through it, or when you can't help them through it, to help them come to terms with the inevitable is also a rewarding part of the job, I find.
So intensive care, you're very sick. Like as you mentioned, your organs are failing and you need intensive, a higher level. Would you say that intensive care is synonymous with life support? Like what's the difference between someone who's on a general hospital ward and those patients who are admitted to intensive care? And does everyone in intensive care need life support? And if so, what is life support?
Yeah, there's different thresholds or reasons or criteria for admission to an intensive care unit, depending on which hospital you're in or where you're at. They fall into two big buckets, I would say. It's either for very close monitoring, where this might be after major surgery, basically like everybody who has open heart surgery goes from the operating room to the cardiovascular intensive care unit for at least 12 hours of monitoring. Other big general surgery or thoracic surgery might also need very close monitoring, and the ICU, part of it is about, it's an interdisciplinary team and a lot of specialized and more one-on-one nursing care. So that's part of it. But then the other major reason people come is because they need, as you say, some form of life support, which is the sort of lay term for organ support. So that might be in the form of mechanical ventilation for their lungs, or it might be in the form of adrenaline or adrenaline-like drugs that help keep blood pressure up. Those are the two things that would most often be triggers sort of physiologically for ICU admission.
So in the Canadian healthcare system, where it's a public dollar, right, publicly funded, where we both work, we really do a good job of working together and collaboratively with our, colleagues, you and I, internal medicine, intensive care, with the emergency doctors. And we really try to use our discretion, right, when deciding who should come into the intensive care unit, because all those things, they're not free, right? One-on-one nursing, respiratory therapy, all the staff who are coming to help, the frequency of blood work, the frequency of monitors, these machines. But in a private institution, if you had $1 billion, right, you just sold SpaceX or some company you own, you made $1 billion. And wouldn't you rather be in an intensive care unit, even if you had a little bit of pneumonia that would normally go to a ward? Because wouldn't your outcomes be better if all these people were looking at you and checking your blood tests every 2 hours?
You know, I think that's certainly the initial knee-jerk reaction that most people would have. And to be fair, it's probably the lived experience of some private hospitals in the United States, for example. If you go visit the Mayo Clinic, their ICUs are very luxurious and they're full of people who are less sick than the average ICU patient is here. But I think that I'd push back a little bit on that, saying that it always would be better to be in the ICU because there are potential downsides. You know, we're checking your blood every 2 hours just to make sure it's fine. Well, guess what? We just did so many blood tests that your hemoglobin level is now low and now you need a blood transfusion. And we did so many tests that we found one of them was abnormal and so we had to send you for a scan, and then, maybe we see something on a scan and now you need to go for an operation to fix something, and they did the operation. Oh, no. So it was a false positive. Actually, you were fine all along. So, there's some there is some downside. It's almost like being a hypochondriac. If you're saying every little ailment, I need to be in an ICU, there's some things that are you have to do proportionately, I think.
Well, it's vitamin T. You know, some people, when they come into hospital and they're getting sick and they say, well, aren't you going to do a chest x-ray every day? And aren't you going to do blood work every day? And, you know, the old wise physician will say, you just need a bit of vitamin T. And they say, well, what's that? And it's time, right? Like you're looking better day over day. We don't need to test all that stuff. And so there is harm with inherently over-investigating people. And then there's harm involved with the treatments that we give, you know, blood transfusions and transfusion reactions. But in those private hospitals, I do think, like I've seen the pictures, you know, these fancy big TV screens, fish tanks, you know, really, it's like a hotel. Perhaps the machines that they offer, like when you talked about how sexy it sounds to offer people machines, you know, ventilators and all this kind of stuff, maybe they have other machines, like a massage chair, right? So like, I think if someone was offering me that, I would want it.
I agree. And I think there's a lot to be said for a nice environment, for an environment that allows families to be present and help with delivery of care and comfort for patients. And, you know, in an ideal world, you'd have a sleeping area for the family member in every room instead of an uncomfortable chair for them to hang out and feel washed up the next day.
Totally. I'm amazed by the devotion and dedication of family members sleeping by the bedside in these awful beds in this noisy room, often smelly, full of interruptions and distractions. But I do think it makes a difference in terms of helping people pull through. You know, we've really gone through a wild conversation here in Journey, kind of talking about where it all started with these machines, the imagery of these medical students pumping air into lungs, the experience of COVID. One thing I just wanted to ask you as we wrap up our conversation is these people are so sick that you're caring for the intensive care unit and they're often out of it. You know, you talked about they have no memory of things and, you know, we're having to put people to sleep and sedate them and paralyze them. And they're often not a part of the conversation, right? Intensive care unit patients are so sick that you're not sitting there and talking to them and, you know, showing them on your phone what the medication looks like, but you're just talking to their family members or if they're not even there to the healthcare team and doing interventions. How do you check yourself and make sure that you're still giving your patients the dignity and credence that they deserve? Like, do you talk to them when you're doing a procedure as if they're wide awake, even though they're not responding to you? And how do you check yourself so you don't lose sight of the fact that that's actually a human there, right? Connected to all these wires and machines. Like, what is something you do to keep that humanity?
Yeah, super, super important question, Mark. I think, and especially in this day and age where we're increasingly doing rounds on computers. And like when we do rounds, we drag about four computers around the ICU outside of the patient room. There's a temptation. You could do rounds from home. You can see all the blood work and all the results and their chest x-ray from anywhere on the planet now that we have this fancy new electronic medical record. But I try to, when I do rounds, when I'm on in the unit, which I'm starting tomorrow, I try to go into every patient's room every day and touch the patient, examine the patient, and talk to the patient. And it doesn't matter whether they're unconscious or not. I have more of a conversation if the patients are awake or unable to interact, but I will do some talking to the patient regardless of, like I'll be explaining what we're doing or what I'm talking about, or if I'm doing some teaching to the residents or fellows and say that, you know, we're just having some shop talk over here about the ventilator. Don't get anxious about this, because it's, we don't know exactly what people experience when they're in a coma and how much they're able to hear or remember anything. So I think it's always, and I always tell family members, if they say, oh, should I talk to them? I say, well, yes, talk to them. If it, it might help. It might help you. It's certainly not going to hurt. And so we don't know, but I think it's very important to agree to remember that we're physicians looking after patients and these are real people with real lives who are catastrophically ill and we're trying to get them back to those lives.
Awesome. Thanks, Neil. Thanks for taking the time out of what sounds like an insane schedule to participate and to share. I really felt that was a great kind of journey and experience to talk through with you and appreciate the language that you use. Very clear and easy to understand. So thanks for joining me in the studio today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What a delight that episode was.
How crazy is it that Dr. Neil Ferguson almost became a golf professional? What a waste of that mind and that passion, you know, that basic science passion, that respiratory physiology, and how he's applied that passion and that interest into the clinical practices that we do. Thank goodness the golf gods didn't sway him over to their side and the medical gods brought him over to our side, because his work is quite meaningful, it's quite impactful, and it's needed. I felt like that was an amazing journey. I learned a lot in speaking with him. Just talking about the history of ventilators, those visuals, medical students pushing air through holes in people's necks to help them stay alive because they were so sick with the virus that impaired their ability to breathe, impaired their ability to clear secretions. That visual is striking. And after our conversation in the studio, he shared with me a book that a colleague of his wrote. And that book is called The Autumn Ghost, How the Battle Against a Polio Epidemic Revolutionized Modern Medical Care. And it was authored by Hannah Wunsch, who's one of his colleagues in critical care medicine, who's actually working in New York right now. And this book so eloquently describes the experience of our healthcare system and the modern revolution that took place as it pertained to ventilatory support and that whole term of life support and intensive care. You know, it was amazing to chat with him about what intensive care and critical care medicine means to him, what machines do in terms of the good that they can cause, but also the harm that they can cause. You know, getting real about the experience of putting someone on a breathing machine, it's crazy stuff. Knocking somebody out with medications, exposing them to the huge risk of side effect and complications, and just the damage that we can cause when we do these procedures, not just putting a breathing tube in someone's lung, but putting these giant intravenous lines, these turkey baster size lines into someone's neck when we're doing that super high tech ECMO procedure, when someone's lungs are so sick that we can't even put them on the ventilator. You know, talking about the humanity of what we do, and him and I, we both work with critically sick patients, and there's times where you're just working with your team, you're connecting people to machines, you're looking at computer screens, looking at oxygen levels, carbon dioxide levels, listening to the beeps and boops of the ventilator. It's sometimes easy to forget that there's actually a human being right there. And that's the work that we're all doing together with our team, with our nursing staff, with our respiratory therapists, with our personal support workers, with our pharmacists. We're working as a team to help people stay alive. And sometimes those people are so out of it because we put them out of it. They're in a medical coma and they're paralyzed that they're not even a part of the conversation. Sometimes they don't even have family members by the bedside to help us. And it's really important that we check ourselves and make sure that we're relaying our plans to our patients in a humane way. We have to remember to speak to our patients, even if they're knocked out, even if they're unaware. We don't know. Are they absorbing those memories? A few months later, just as Neil Ferguson described, people are walking out of the hospital. People survive these treatments. Do they remember what we did for them? Do they remember the sound of our voices? Even though they seem to not be aware, what are they absorbing? We don't know. And as healthcare workers, we need to understand that there's a lot of things that we don't know and that we don't understand. And we can't lose sight of that. We can't lose sight of our humanity. The COVID pandemic, debriefing that, as I do with many of my guests on the show. When this happened, it was a scary time. You know, and Dr. Ferguson had a lot of responsibility that he had to manage. These conversations that we shared today and little tidbits in our podcast about getting hospitals ready for these surges and large volumes of people needing ventilators, you know, ripping out all the chairs in the cafeteria to fit hospital beds and to fit ventilators, connecting two people to one ventilator. These were actual conversations that were happening. These were actual fears and anxieties that we all had in healthcare, given all of the unknowns that came with COVID. And it's so funny in retrospect because we know so much now and we learned a lot. You know, do steroids work? Ivermectin, antiviral treatments, antibodies, which of those things worked? Which of those things hurt?
which people needed to be placed on ventilators, which people could ride it out with oxygen levels in the 70s. It was a wild ride. It was a crazy collective experience. But as our collective experience grew, and as people like Dr. Ferguson did meaningful research work with his collaborators, with his teams, to understand how to manage these patients, how to prepare for them, even how to purpose our healthcare system with respect to ventilator pools and creative ways to help our patients, it was a collective learning experience that will hopefully embody us to be best prepared for the next pandemic, if and when that comes, and inevitably it will. And then the surges in the usual seasonal viruses, influenza, RSV, it's taught us a lot about how to communicate with our patients, how to work together as teams. And it's also informed the population at large, everyone in our listening audience. Even before this conversation that I had today, I'm sure you were much more familiar and comfortable with terms like intensive care, critical care, and ventilators than you were pre-pandemic. Hopefully today's conversation helped to fill some extra gaps. Hopefully you found this journey as insightful and as informative as I did today. As always, I appreciate my guests, my production team, my engineers for getting all of this together so that we could share this informative conversation globally. Thanks again for checking in. Be sure to share, be sure to subscribe, be sure to like, and we'll see you at the next episode. Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.